From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Within 5 days of coming here, he died, in the custody of the Department of Homeland Security. And here you had a very extreme case of someone who was very old, who had a visa, who had a passport, who had a history of coming here, and who was still treated that way. I think it's very telling about the way that Haitian asylum seekers are generally treated here when they come here to the United States.
Award-winning Haitian-American author Edwidge Dantecott, speaking after the death of her 81-year-old uncle at Crome, the Florida detention center, nearly 3 years ago. He died in U.S. custody after fleeing Haiti, seeking political asylum here in the United States. Edwidge Dantecott tells her story in her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. She testified yesterday before Congress. But first, Canadian authorities bar two leading U.S. peace activists, Medea Benjamin and retired Colonel Anne Wright, from entering Canada after their names appear on an FBI criminal database. And we'll speak with an organizer who's entering the second month of a fast to protest the failure of lawmakers in Washington to address climate change. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Up to 24 Iraqi civilians are reportedly dead following a U.S. airstrike near the city of Baquba. Another 27 people were wounded. The toll is said to include women and children. Witnesses say at least 4 homes were leveled in the attack. Some of the victims were killed after rushing out of their homes to help those hurt in the initial bombing. A new showdown is brewing on Capitol Hill over the disclosure the Justice Department secretly issued memos granting expansive approval for harsh interrogation techniques. Democrats want the White House to turn over classified memos that reportedly authorize methods including head slapping, simulated drowning, and frigid temperatures. The existence of the memos was disclosed by the New York Times. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair John Rockefeller of West Virginia said, quote, "I find it unfathomable that the committee tasked with oversight of the CIA's detention and interrogation program would be provided more information by the New York Times than by the Department of Justice." White House Press Secretary Dana Perino confirmed the memos were issued but refused to discuss their contents.
I am not going to comment on any specific alleged techniques. It is not appropriate for me to do so, and to do so would provide the enemy with more information for how to train against these techniques. And so I'm going to decline to comment on those, but I will reiterate to you once again that we do not torture. We want to make sure that we keep this country safe.
On Capitol Hill, the House has overwhelmingly approved a measure that would subject private military contractors in Iraq to prosecution in U.S. courts. The move comes on the heels of last month's killing of up to 28 Iraqi civilians by guards working for the private military firm Blackwater USA. The bill would not be retroactive, meaning Blackwater guards would still likely avoid prosecution. The final vote was 389-30. If the measure attracts the same support in the Senate, Congress would have enough votes to override a presidential veto. Meanwhile, evidence continues to emerge. The Blackwater shooting was unprovoked. A newly disclosed Pentagon report from the attack scene says Blackwater guards were the first to fire and use excessive force. The newly revealed reports follow evidence showing the Blackwater guards opened fire in another attack just minutes after the first shooting. Iraqi witnesses say Blackwater operatives fired into a group of cars just 150 yards away from the first shooting at Nisour Square. At least one person was killed and 2 injured. In news from Washington, Idaho Senator Larry Craig has announced he won't be stepping down. Craig pleaded guilty in August to disorderly conduct in a men's bathroom. Craig made the decision despite a court's refusal to let him withdraw his guilty plea. New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici has announced he won't seek re-election next year. The 75-year-old Republican has been diagnosed with a degenerative brain disease. The Hill newspaper is reporting Republican Congressmember Heather Wilson will run for Domenici's seat. Both Wilson and Domenici were wrapped up in the scandal over the firing of U.S. Attorney David Iglesias. In Burma, the military junta is refusing to meet the detained pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi unless she drops all of her key demands. A government presenter announced the decision on state television Thursday.
7. At the Gadesi Gol, State Peace and Development Council Chairman Senior General Ban Shui mentioned, Mr. Gambari, that Aung San Suu Kyi has been exerting efforts for confrontation, utter devastation and imposing all kinds of sanctions, including economic sanctions against Myanmar. If she declares to give them up, the senior general will personally meet her.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been in detention for 12 of the 18 years since her 1990 election. The current uprising in Burma marks the strongest challenge to the ruling junta in nearly 20 years. On Thursday, the junta admitted to arresting more than 2,000 people in the government crackdown on the protests. But dissident groups and foreign diplomats say some 6,000 people are behind bars, with hundreds believed dead. Protests in support of the Burmese uprising continue worldwide. On Thursday, dozens rallied in Tokyo outside the Burma embassy. This is Burmese exile Myint Swe.
Though people in Myanmar cannot watch us protesting, as internet connection here has been cut off, officers working in embassies around the world must have seen our protest and heard our voices.
Global protests against the military junta in Burma are planned for Saturday, October 6th. In Chile, the widow and five children of the late dictator Augusto Pinochet have been arrested on corruption charges. The Pinochet family was detained as part of an ongoing probe into allegations Augusto Pinochet had tens of millions of dollars in public funds and foreign banks. This is Chilean President Michelle Bachelet.
Nobody in Chile can believe that justice cannot be met or that they are immune to the system. So I believe that we should be calm and wait for the outcome. But I think that it's valid that there is justice and that it has a role to play.
Arrest warrants have been issued for another 17 people, including retired military generals and former Pinochet confidants. A group of veteran diplomats and activists known as the Elders have wrapped up a visit to Sudan and Darfur. The group, including former President Jimmy Carter, the human rights campaigner Graca Machel, and the former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, harshly criticized the Sudanese government for the treatment of Darfurian refugees. Graca Machel described the conditions inside the refugee camps.
Every single person we spoke to, the first thing they told us, they need security. They need security. They gave us examples of what happened to them, even graphically, to show how women are being raped, are beaten, and are brutalized. I think because they thought we may not get a clear translation, they went at length of using justice to show us how brutal it was.
Former President Jimmy Carter assailed Sudan for what he called a crime against humanity, but he warned against labeling the conflict in Darfur a genocide.
It's not genocide, and to call it genocide falsely just to exaggerate a horrible situation, I don't think it helps. Sure. I'm not derogating or minimizing the problem at all. But, you know, genocide is reserved as a term for a special case that's horrendous.
While Carter's fellow elder, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, was allowed to visit Darfur, he won't be welcome at the campus of One Minnesota University. The University of St. Thomas has canceled Tutu's scheduled appearance for the spring of next year. School officials say they're barring Tutu because of previous statements he's made, quote, against Israeli policy. Tutu has compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories to South Africa under apartheid. St. Thomas professor Marv Davidoff said, quote, as a Jew who experienced real anti-Semitism as a child, I'm deeply disturbed that a man like Tutu could be labeled anti-Semitic and silenced like this. I deeply resent the Israeli lobby trying to silence any criticism of its policy. It does a great disservice to Israel and to all Jews, Marv Davidoff said. The World Bank is being accused of backing the destruction of the world's second largest forest. An independent audit says World Bank officials have encouraged foreign companies to excessively log the rainforest in the Congo, endangering the lives of thousands of Congolese pygmies. According to the Guardian newspaper, the World Bank is also accused of misleading the Congo's government about the forest value. Some 40 million people depend on Congo's forests for medicine, shelter, and food. The family of an openly gay National Guard member found dead in Afghanistan is raising questions over whether she was murdered. Family members say Siar Durkin told them last month she feared retribution over objections she'd raised to unspecified activity at the Bagram airfield. Durkin is said to have warned her family members to call for an investigation in case anything happened to her. She was found shot once in the head last week. And the Olympic gold medalist track star Marion Jones has admitted to using steroids. For years, Jones has denied allegations she's used performance-enhancing drugs. Jones is expected to plead guilty today in a New York court. In a letter to family and friends, she apologized and said she'd been unknowingly given the drugs by her personal trainer. Jones' admission could strip her of the 5 medals she won in the 2000 Summer Olympics in Sydney, Australia. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 leading U.S. peace activists were denied entry into Canada Wednesday after their names appeared on an FBI criminal database that the Canadian government's using at its borders. Anne Wright, a retired Army colonel and former diplomat, and Medea Benjamin, co-founder of women's peace group Code Pink, were headed to Toronto to discuss peace and security issues at the invitation of the Toronto Stop the War Coalition. Canadian authorities detained and questioned them for several hours at the border crossing between Buffalo and Niagara Falls. The 2 women were apparently denied entry into Canada because their names appeared on an FBI-run international criminal database. And Wright and Medea Benjamin do have 9 convictions between them, but all involving civil disobedience committed while protesting the Iraq War. On Thursday, they met with immigration officials at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C., and held a news conference outside. Anne Wright joins me now from Washington, D.C. She's a retired Army colonel, former diplomat who quit a 16-year State Department career following the invasion of Iraq in March 2003. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Anne.
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Explain exactly what happened.
Well, Medea and I had gone up to Buffalo, New York, going across the border on the Rainbow Bridge to go on up to Toronto for a peace conference, and we were stopped by the immigration authorities and said that our names appeared on the National Crime Information Center database furnished by the FBI, and that we had been convicted of offenses, and those offenses meant that we were now ineligible to enter Canada.
And did they go further?
Well, they said, yes, we, in order to be, to ever be eligible to go to Canada, we would have to fill out a criminal rehabilitation packet, 18 pages worth of all of your history. We also can't have an arrest within 5 years of submitting that package. So for Medea and myself and many other peace activists who consider civil disobedience as a part of a technique to bring light to what's going on, particularly on ending this war in Iraq, we can never be criminally rehabilitated, nor do we want to be, from standing up for truth and justice and stopping an illegal war on Iraq.
So, Anne, you are turned back at the border. You go to back to Washington, D.C. You meet with Canadian officials at the embassy. What did they tell you?
Well, they told us that any time that the FBI puts people on this NCIC list, they just accept it at face value, that they don't really investigate things. And we kept saying, well, you ought to, because a lot of these things appear to be going on to this list because of political intimidation. Because, indeed, the list itself on for the database says that people like foreign fugitives, people on the 10 most wanted list or 100 most wanted list, people that are part of violent gangs and terrorist organizations are supposed to go on that NCIC list. It didn't seem like that we were a part of, we haven't done anything to be on the list. And since this thing is just now, we are the first ones that we know of that have been formally stopped from going into Canada. In fact, it happened to me in August when I went up to Canada to participate in the Security and Prosperity Partnership. I had to buy my way in, $200 for a 3-day temporary resident permit. If I'm so dangerous, why would they even give me that permit? I asked the immigration officer in the Canadian embassy.
I want to say that we also called the Canadian border agents. We called the Canadian embassy in Washington. We called the Canadian consulate in New York. We got no response back. We wanted to have them on. But, Anne, I wanted to talk about your background. Anne Wright, you're a retired Army colonel. You earned a master's degree in national security affairs from the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, later participated in the reconstruction efforts of U.S. military actions in Grenada and Somalia. You went on to serve 13 years in active duty in the U.S. Army, 16 years in the Army Reserve at the rank of colonel. You went on to work at the State Department. You served as chief of mission at the U.S. embassies in Afghanistan, which you voluntarily helped open the embassy there after the U.S. attacked Afghanistan in 2001. Served in Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Mongolia, Uzbekistan. You got a State Department Award for heroism for helping evacuate 2,500 people from the civil war in Sierra Leone. Is the U.S. government or the Canadian government, how have they responded to your background? And also elaborate further on the FBI database.
Well, they don't consider my background at all, that I have had extensive experience, that the reason that I feel it is very important for me to be protesting is that I do bring both a military and a diplomatic background to my concerns about what's going on in Iraq and potentially in Iran and certainly in Afghanistan, where I did serve in December of 2001. I would say that the immigration officer at the Canadian embassy found it very interesting that I had had all of this experience, but as he said, it really doesn't matter to us what your background is. As long as you arrive on that database, we really don't question it. But what we're asking Canadian members of parliament to question whether or not their government should be, just following wholesale anything the U.S. government tells them to do. In fact, we have a letter from Olivia Chow, one of the members of Congress, that says, in Canada, peaceful protest is not criminal activity, despite how some U.S. agencies may regard it. In the future, I trust that people like Ms. Wright and Ms. Benjamin will be welcomed into Canada based on appropriate standards decided by the Canadian government and not by any other foreign body. And I think the Canadians are absolutely right. I think the Bush administration is really pushing down the throats of a lot of countries' methods to control dissent here in the United States of America. And those countries ought to say to the Bush administration, stop this. We can determine who ought to be coming into our country and who should not, and not based on what you think they are doing in your country.
Colonel Ann Wright, I wanted to ask you about the issue of torture, something you have protested against many times. On Thursday, the New York Times revealed the Justice Department, under former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, issued a series of secret legal opinions effectively sanctioning the use of torture. These are excerpts from the Thursday White House press briefing with Dana Perino.
Well, just generally, does the administration, does the president believe that head slapping and simulated drowning are necessary tactics to use against suspected terrorists to keep America safe?
I am not going to comment on any specific alleged techniques. It is not appropriate for me to do so, and to do so would provide the enemy with more information for how to train against these techniques. And so I'm going to decline to comment on those, but I will reiterate to you once again that we do not torture. We want to make sure that we keep this country safe.
In September of last year, the president told the country about what had been a classified program of mm-hmm. CIA prisons mm-hmm. in other countries around the world. At that time, he said all the terrorists who were held or alleged terrorists who were held in those sites were no longer there. Today, do those prisons still exist, and are there alleged terrorists being held?
I'm not going to comment on that. If the CIA decides to comment, I'll let them. What I can tell you is that any procedures that they use are tough, safe, necessary, and lawful.
It's reasonable to assume if those prisons were closed that the president would have deemed that something to tell the country, and in the absence of that, we should assume they are still working?
I'm not going to comment.
In a conference call in July, a senior administration official said that they would no longer or wouldn't use extreme temperatures of heat and cold. Is that true?
I don't know. I don't recall.
I guess the point is that if a senior administration official told us on a conference call that these methods wouldn't be used, why won't you say whether or not head slapping, waterboarding would be used?
I don't believe that. I'm not in a position to be able to do that. I'm not going to comment on specific techniques. Now, if there were an attack on this country, all of the questions in here would be very different. You would be asking me, how did you allow this to happen? And what I am telling you is that within the law, we are making sure we are doing everything we can to prevent it from happening again.
But what's to stop another country from then taking their own definition and interpretation based on the administration?
Well, as I understand it, under the Geneva Convention, every country was supposed to interpret it for themselves. And now we have. As I understand it, I believe that the Geneva Conventions, that every country could interpret for themselves what that language meant. I'm recalling that from the debate that we had in this country from a year and a half ago.
Paraphrasing what the Geneva Convention said.
Not paraphrasing, but you're going to paraphrase? Okay.
Paraphrasing what it said, it basically says that if there is some kind of a problem with clarity, it is supposed to be taken to an international crimes court. So we're...
Which we are not going to do.
Why not?
I don't think it's necessary.
Dana Perino, White House press secretary, being grilled by the press. Retired Army Colonel Ann Wright, you have protested torture. Your response?
Well, I think Dana Perino needs to have a little counseling on how you answer these questions. What she has done is created a lot more people who hate America. I mean, this whole issue that we are still debating, or that the administration is still doing secret memos that show that we indeed are torturing people, I mean, that's creating more people that hate America. The attacks that possibly could come on America would happen exactly because of what the Bush administration is doing. Torture techniques don't get you any more information. It just gets you bad information. I'm very concerned that the CIA still has this authority to do those types of techniques that are truly torture. Our military has been told not to do them, but many times the military and CIA are together in same areas, and our military will start seeing that they'll start doing the same old thing they were doing in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So Dana Perino continues to muddy the waters about torture. We should be saying we don't torture, and we should not be torturing. It is just creating more enemies for the United States that we don't need to be doing this sort of thing.
Finally, Ann Wright, this weekend is the anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. You went to Afghanistan voluntarily to reopen the mission as you were working for the State Department. What are your thoughts today?
Well, here it is almost 6 years later, and I would say that a better response would have not been the military response, that they're a beefed up, a strong, very strong international law response probably would have had more results on going after al-Qaeda than what 6 years of in many ways, a limited military response has done. I think the Bush administration has been, what has happened in Afghanistan has really sunk the country into a big morass that's getting deeper and deeper now. The potential for real help to the people of Afghanistan, I think the window of opportunity is closing tragically very fast.
Retired Colonel Ann Wright, I want to thank you for being with us. Refused entry into Canada, along with Code Pink founder Medea Benjamin, because Canadian authorities said her name appeared on a criminal FBI database. For our radio listeners who can't see what Ann is wearing, her black T-shirt has white letters across the front that says, "We will not be silent." The United Nations Emergency Relief Coordinator has warned the world has seen a record number of floods, droughts, and storms caused by climate change this year. Sir John Holmes told The Guardian newspaper the dire predictions about the impact of global warming on humanity were already coming true. The UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has issued a record 13 emergency appeals this year, although one of the appeals dealt with a climate-related disaster. The UN believes 66 million people were made homeless or were affected by the catastrophic flooding in Asia this year. Just this week, the UN issued a call for emergency funds for Ghana, where flooding has left more than 400,000 people homeless. Our next guest, Ted Glick, is the coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council. He's on the 32nd day of a water-only fast to protest the failure of lawmakers in Washington, D.C. to address climate change. Ted Glick is also helping to organize No War, No Warming action in Washington on October 22nd. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ted.
Thank you, Amy. I appreciate it.
I saw you in Newark, New Jersey at an anti-war protest. You are a lot thinner now. How much weight have you lost?
I lost about 30 pounds.
Why are you doing this?
One thing I do want to correct, I fasted on water only for 25 days. Since then, I'm now onto liquids. I'm taking fruit and vegetable juices and miso broth, but I am continuing the fast. I have no plans for when I'm going to end it. This is a climate emergency fast. It was begun on September 4th, the day that the U.S. Congress came back into session after its summer recess. Both Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid said prior to that, the opening of that fall session, that they wanted to have global warming legislation passed this fall. It should be noted, Nancy Pelosi said when she came into office back in January that she wanted to have global warming legislation passed by July 4th. That didn't happen. It should also be noted that this summer there were two versions of an energy bill passed, one by the Senate, one by the House. They're not the same. It's now a month since this Congress came back, and nothing is happening as far as moving forward to try to reconcile the two versions of that energy bill. Neither the Republicans are dragging their feet, and the Democrats are not using the power that they have to move this forward. As far as global warming legislation, there are committees that are meeting. There are a variety of different pieces of legislation that have been introduced. The best one, the strongest one, is the Safe Climate Act, as it's called in the House. It has 140 co-sponsors, introduced by Henry Waxman. It would reduce carbon emissions 80% by 2050 and begin the process within a year or two of passage of reducing emissions, which is absolutely what we have to do. But it's committee work that's going on. I went to Capitol Hill about 2 weeks ago. I went around to about 15 offices in the House and the Senate talking to key people who were involved in these efforts to come up with climate legislation. I came away from that convinced that barring a grassroots political uprising, barring people in this country demanding of their senators and their congresspeople that they get it on the urgency of this crisis, that we will be lucky to see any bill coming out of committee and onto one of the floors of Congress before sometime next year. There is no sense of urgency about the climate crisis, just as we see with the war, there is no sense of the need to get our troops out and to take whatever actions are necessary when it comes to the Democratic Party leadership and the few Republicans who are willing to also move in that direction. So there is a need for, quite frankly, more extreme actions. I'll admit that a fast is extreme. It's something you do. A lot of fasts tend to come from prisoners. I was in prison myself during the Vietnam War for about a year. My first hunger strike was with Father Philip Berrigan during my time in Danbury Federal Prison. That's where usually hunger strikes come from. But I became involved with this action, and other people have participated in this action, because in many ways we are in a prison right now. We have a federal government that is ignoring the needs of the American people, conducting an illegal war, doing very little in terms of responding to the urgency on climate crisis on one issue after the other. We are in many ways in a prison. So this fast is a way of saying, let's step it up. Let's move the agenda. Let's do more than we've done. That's what I'm trying to get across in the strongest way that I know how.
And your plan for October 22nd?
October 22nd is the primary action that No War, No Warming is organizing. Here in Washington, D.C., there will be many hundreds, hopefully thousands of people who on that Monday, on a day that Congress is in session, we're going to be up on Capitol Hill. We're going to be erecting windmill blockades in intersections. We're going to be sitting in front of doors. There'll be bicycle blockades. There will be various creative, nonviolent actions to let this Congress know that people are really outraged at the lack of action on the war, the lack of action on global warming, the lack of action on putting resources into New Orleans, rebuilding the Gulf Coast, putting resources into communities that need them, healthcare, education. It goes right down the line. These people need to understand we're angry. We're not going to just sit back and do the same old things. We're willing to step it up. We're willing to use our bodies. That's what I'm doing with this fast and what I hope many other people will do in the ways that they can and join with us on October 22nd in D.C., as well as around the country. There's actions around the country, part of No War, No Warming. There's more information at our website, nowarnowarming.org.
We're going to leave it there. Ted Glick, thank you for joining us, coordinator of the U.S. Climate Emergency Council on the 32nd day of a climate emergency fast. Please take care of yourself. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by the Haitian-American author Edwige Dantekat. Stay with us. Artist Soanne, well-known folk singer who was imprisoned for Haiti, in Haiti for years. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Immigrant detention centers constitute one of the fastest-growing forms of incarceration in the U.S. Currently, there are 30,000 immigrants in detention. Nearly 300,000 are detained each year. They're held in private federal or county prisons across the country for weeks, even months, while the government decides whether to deport them. According to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, which is a division of the Department of Homeland Security, one quarter of the people they detain suffer chronic health conditions. ICE claims to spend $98 million a year on health care for detainees and to provide them with, quote, humane and safe detention environments. But at least 65 people have died in ICE custody since 2004. The House Judiciary Committee organized a hearing Thursday afternoon on the subject. Tom Jawitz of the ACLU Prison Project called the care at the detention centers, quote, grossly deficient, inexcusable, and immoral. Edwige Dantekat is an award-winning Haitian-born writer, now lives in Miami, Florida. She testified at Thursday's congressional hearing. In November of 2004, her 81-year-old uncle, Reverend Joseph Dantekat, died in the Chrome Detention Center in Miami. He just fled Haiti after hiding from an armed gang that threatened to kill him because United Nations and Haitian police forces had fired shots from the roof of his church. Reverend Dantekat arrived at Miami International Airport with a multiple entry visa, said he was applying for temporary political asylum. He was immediately detained. His medicines were taken away from him. A medic at Chrome accused him of, quote, faking his illness. He died a few days later. Edwige Dantekat tells this devastating story in her latest book. It's a memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. She joins me now from Miami, Florida. We welcome you, Edwige Dantekat, to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Talk about your testimony yesterday.
Yesterday, I tried to paint a picture of my uncle, of what he meant to us, but also to link his cause to the greater cause of mistreatment and lack of medical care of immigrants in detention. In his case, when he arrived, as you said, his medications were taken away, but also the fact that he became ill in a hearing in front of an immigration judge, and that wasn't taken seriously. So that brought, you know, his case and many of the cases needs to be brought to attention. I mean, other people need to know about it.
You describe graphically in your book how he died and what it meant as you frantically called, tried to reach your uncle at the prison. Describe how he was taken to Chrome along with his son and what happened to him there.
Well, as soon as he arrived at the airport, my uncle had been coming
to the United States for about 30 years to visit, and he had a visa, he had a passport. But when he requested asylum, he knew that he would stay longer. He was arrested, and he was held for a little bit in an airport detention place, and then he was taken on a bus and brought to Qom. We didn't speak to him. I didn't speak to him until the following Monday, where he described the fact that his medication was taken away, and and he had been through an awful lot in Haiti, so it was very, very traumatic. I mean, he was going through a very difficult time. I used in the book, we had to file a Freedom of Information request to get his records, and I use very much the interviews and the details that I get from the government report, so that we're not accused of of embellishing things. I use pretty almost in some cases word for word what they said happened to him.
I'd like to step back for a minute. Your deeply moving memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, is the story of your uncle, who also was a second father to you, raising you in Haiti, and your father here in New York. Take us back to where you were born, and how you were raised, where you were raised, and the relationship you had with these two men.
Well, I was born in Port-au-Prince in 1969. It was during the Duvalier dictatorship. My family is originally from a village in the countryside in Haiti, and my uncle, who was the patriarch of our family, was the oldest, and he was the first to come to the city. And his other siblings followed, including my father. He was a politically active man in his youth. He was a great follower of a man named Daniel Fignolet, who was a very popular leader. And when Fignolet was unseated by and replaced by Duvalier, he joined a church. And Bel Air, which is now one of the poorest areas in Haiti, but still a very politically involved area, was one of the most beautiful areas. And eventually, throughout the years, it became very poor. But my uncle remained there for more than 50 years and worked in his church. My father, on the other hand, moved to Brooklyn, where he was a cab driver for many years. So I grew up with both men for the first 12 years of my life. My father left when I was two. So I spent 10 years with my uncle, and then came to New York at age 12 to be reunited with my father. So the book is about the two of them, and really how, it's because it was strange to me when all this was over that now both my father and my uncle are buried in Queens, New York. I think something that neither of them had imagined. So I tried to trace their journeys and also a bit of my journey.
Edwidge, describe what it was like to live with your uncle and aunt in Haiti, to have your parents visit, but what that was like to reunite with your parents, though you considered your uncle and aunt your parents as well, what it was like to leave Haiti.
Well, my experience is not atypical of a lot of families who are touched by migration. My father came first, and then we followed. But growing up with my aunt and uncle, we were just a large extended family. There were many of us in the same situation whose parents had migrated to New York or to Canada and some to the Dominican Republic. So we were all these children in the house with my uncle and my aunt. And my uncle, because he was part of the church, we had a larger community. My parents came to visit once because they came back to get their residency. And then it was about 5 years after they got their residency that we were able to join them. And in the meantime, we had to take paternity tests, all the immigration obstacles and, sort of all the steps. We took all this time, and we had to go through all that before we came together to live in New York in a predominantly Caribbean area in East Flatbush in Brooklyn.
How did you adjust to New York and to your parents, your new family, your little brothers who you hadn't lived with before?
Well, it took a little bit of adjustment. First of all, with New York, I didn't speak the language, and it took a while. I was in an English as a second language class. And with my brothers, it was we were lucky in that it was immediately, we came together pretty quickly. And I think my parents worked very hard on trying to join us together. But it was a very difficult time to come to New York, because I came in 1981, and it was a time where people were first talking about AIDS, and Haitians were put on, stigmatized as on the high-risk list there. And so a lot of the people in my parents' building, for example, were losing their job because people didn't know very much about AIDS, and we were on the list. And then people were just beginning to come by boat in large numbers to Miami. So these were the things that, you know, people immediately associated with us as young Haitian kids in school, kids or teachers, and so forth. So it was a difficult time, but it was, you know, it was also very instructive time.
How did you become a writer?
I became a writer because I come from a very strong storytelling culture, and also because of all these things that I witnessed. I think very early on when we got here, my dad used to take me to visit Haitian detainees at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where they were held then, and just observing different things. I always thought I wanted to document things, and the way that the storytellers of my childhood told stories, that's really what made me want to be a writer.
Can you now talk about the later part of your father's life? Because Brother I'm Dying is about two brothers, your dad and your uncle, and how within a few days you had lost both of them. Talk about your father's sickness and what it meant, how you coped.
Well, my father had spent more than 25 years as a gypsy cab driver in New York, and when he became sick in the summer of 2004, he was diagnosed with pulmonary fibrosis. We thought that might have something to do with, you know, being out on the street all that time driving a cab. So he died of a very painful lung disease. It took him about 9 months in bed. He slowly died, but the way he died is very, in contrast to my uncle's sudden death, was very prolonged. And we had a chance to have some extraordinary conversations about his life, about the family, and even about immigration and what that means and the sacrifices that you made, and just personal things. And I was pregnant at the same time with my daughter. And, you know, we had an opportunity to have a lot of conversations about the future, about personal things, political things. And I feel very lucky that we'd had that time together, because my father really, he was the model immigrant, if you will, who he worked extraordinarily long hours, and he managed to buy a house, to build a life here at great sacrifice and at great cost. And so I'm very lucky that we had a chance to examine that, and I have a chance to also share that in the book.
We have to break, but we're going to come back to the great award-winning Haitian-American novelist, writer. Edwidge Dontaut's books include Breath, Eyes, Memory, The Farming of Bones, Crick Crack, and The Dewbreaker. Her latest is called Brother, I'm Dying. It's a memoir. We'll be back with Edwidge in a minute.
Thank you.
Rahman Experience here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Edwige Dantecat, the award-winning Haitian-American writer. Her latest book is a memoir. It's called Brother, I'm Dying. Edwige, I was wondering if you could read from your book.
Yes, I'll read a little bit towards the end. After my Uncle Joseph died, my father told me that he dreamed of him only once, and never in the small group he pictured around his bed. In my father's dream, when my uncle calls him from New York the night he nearly died, my father actually makes it there on time to ride in the ambulance with him and hold his hands. He must have been so scared, my father said, not knowing whether he was going to live or die. Like perhaps most people whose loved ones have died, I wish I had some guarantees about the afterlife. I wish I were absolutely certain that my father and uncle are now together in some tranquil and restful place, sharing endless walks and talks beyond what their too few and too short visits allowed. I wish I knew that they were offering enough comfort to one another to allow them both not to remember their distressing, even excruciating, final hours and days. I wish I could fully make sense of the fact that they're now sharing a gravesite and tombstone in Queens, New York, after living apart for more than 30 years. In any case, every now and then, I try to imagine them in a walk through the mountains of Beauséjour in Haiti. It's dawn, a dazzling morning over the green hills. The sun is slowly rising, burning through the fog. They're peacefully making their way down the zigzag trail that joins the villages to the rest of the world below. And in my imagining, whenever they lose track of one another, one or the other calls out in a voice that echoes throughout the hills, Koto Yefrem, brother, where are you? And the other one quickly answers, Mwela, right here. Brother, I am right here.
Edwige Dantecat reading from her new memoir. It's called Brother, I'm Dying. The last chapter where you have, where in the last few chapters, your uncle and your father are dying. You're in Miami, you're pregnant. Describe speaking with your father, learning about what was happening with your uncle at Chrome, trying to bring an attorney in, what that whole process was in dealing with Chrome, and then trying to find out what happened afterwards.
Well, it began at the airport. My uncle called me from the airport, and he's saying, actually, the customs people from the airport called, and they said that my uncle was going to Chrome. And then immediately we tried to get a lawyer, but it was the weekend. He arrived on a Friday, so there was no getting into Chrome until Monday morning. So Monday morning, we got a lawyer who was trying to get him a humanitarian parole because he was 81 years old and not well. And so he had a credible fear hearing scheduled the next day. The lawyer got in there. And when he became ill and was taken first to the hospital unit at Chrome and then to Jackson Memorial, we tried very hard to see him. That was the beginning of sort of the dealing with the bureaucracy of that, because technically when a detainee is in the custody of the ICE or the Department of Homeland Security, you have to go through a whole series of steps. And furthermore, he was in a prison ward, and even the attorney could not visit him in the prison ward. So we were not allowed to see him. But the difficult part of that transaction, the most difficult part also, was communicating some of that to my father, which was the beginning of, I guess, the narration of this book, in the sense that trying to craft a story for my father that would not break his heart, because he was also at death's door at that point and was very emotionally affected, physically affected by the emotions of that. So it was just going between the two of them and dealing with the bureaucracy. And after he died, we were basically they gave us the corpse, and it had been autopsied, and they gave him a cause of death, a disease. They said he had acute and chronic pancreatitis, which he had never had any symptoms of, and which he was not diagnosed or treated or screened for at Chrome or at Jackson. So basically, they gave us a corpse and the clothes that he had been wearing, and that was supposed to be it, until we started asking for his medical records to find out what had happened. And we had to file a Freedom of Information request for the records and eventually a lawsuit in order to get the his records from Chrome.
And what did you find?
Excuse me?
And what did you find? And one of the things I was most struck by in the book, at the point where your uncle got so sick at Chrome, was all of the bureaucracy that had to be gone through, even to get him to the hospital, as you looked at those documents.
Oh, yes, because first of all, they had to establish, I guess, take his illness seriously. And eventually there was the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. They did an investigation, which we called for, among other places, on your show when you were kind enough to have us in the middle of all of this. And the investigation eventually did take place. And what it was, I was surprised, because I had never seen. We also had to do a Freedom of Information request for the investigation. And what it turned out to be was a series of, a lot of it was redacted, but a series of interviews they had done with us and with the medics and so forth. And among the things that we found out is that this medic, these people who had been interviewed, said things like, well, you know, we have experience with this, and we can tell if people are faking. He was looking at me, he was not limp, and things like that. So only after we had gotten some of these documents, which I think is probably a fraction of what actually exists, because a lot of it is blank when you get a FOIA request, did we get some clue as to what happened to him, also the bureaucracy involved. And we saw this in some of the hearing yesterday when people were talking, and I wasn't aware of this when it was happening to me, that, for example, people in detention, especially in ICE detention, are supposedly only allowed medical care in emergency situations. That is, I mean, you have to be writhing on the floor sometimes to get care. And sometimes if you have a request for a certain kind of care, it has to go all the way to Washington. This was a revelation to me also in the judiciary hearing yesterday.
You describe how your uncle had the added complication of not being able to speak, though he was a preacher in Haiti. He had lost his ability and had to put a machine to his throat to be able to be heard.
Yes, he had had cancer surgery some years ago and needed a voice box to speak, and had to be, if anyone who's seen this in process, you have to be erect, you have to be sitting down, you have to be propped up in order to use the voice box. So if he's weakened, he's not going to be able to communicate if he's not. So people who, if you don't have a history of dealing with patients like that, he wouldn't be able to communicate what he needed to say. But it wasn't made easy, because even when he was vomiting and the vomit had gotten on the voice box, there was not really much. If you're not taken seriously when you become ill, people are not going to make extra efforts to communicate with you, especially if you have difficulties.
The issue of translating at these detention centers, of being able to communicate, as your uncle was getting deathly ill, going into a comatose state, not even being able to find a Creole interpreter.
They had a Creole interpreter, in his case, at on the phone. So they were doing, he was in the middle of this hearing, and it's not unusual that they have the phone interpreters. I think in his case, the problem was more not being heard, because there were other detainees there who were called in eventually to translate for him. So that is a problem in some cases. In his case, it was not the problem as much as the fact that even when people understood what his needs were, they were not heard or acted on.
Was your father ever able to meet your baby before he died?
He was, and it was one of the, I mean, in the middle of all this, the sadness, it was one of the great things. I think there's especially for families like mine, where you have years of separation and you have this sort of fragmentation. I think for my father, it was so important to meet my daughter, and a lot of our conversations were about that. And she's named Mia, she's named after him. And they were able to spend a month together before he died. And I think that meant a great deal to him, and certainly means a great deal to me as we go forward. It's a very continuation in a family like mine is a very important thing because of all these separations, because of some live here, some live there. So it was just wonderful for me, and I think for him too that was able to happen.
Edwidge Dantacott, I wanted to turn now to a different but related issue. There are an estimated 700,000 Haitian immigrants in neighboring Dominican Republic. The Dominican Constitution grants citizenship to those born on Dominican soil, except to the children of diplomats and those, quote, in transit through the country. Recently, the Dominican Supreme Court ruled that Haitian workers were, quote, in transit and staying in the country illegally. The children born to Haitian parents are thus denied Dominican citizenship. In protests, the Grassroots Haiti Solidarity Committee organized a picket Thursday in front of the Dominican consulate in New York. Democracy Now! Spoke to some of the people at the protest.
Today, I'm here for Haitian workers in the Dominican Republic. Basically, they are treated as wage slaves, as they are here in the United States. A couple of months ago, there was an attack on some Haitian workers with some machete attack by some other Dominican workers. But the bigger issue here is the fact that the United States, they're producing these products for the United States, and the United States is basically using Dominican Republic as a colony.
The government of the Dominican Republic, as the representative of the ruling classes in the Dominican Republic, the bourgeoisie, and also the big land owners, the big plantation owners in the Dominican Republic, are behind this kind of xenophobic persecution of Haitians in the Dominican Republic.
The Dominican government that's carrying this out, but this whole system that was set up of basically exploiting near slave labor was set up by the United States when it was occupying both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. So the ultimate responsibility for this is, in fact, with the U.S. government.
Voices of protest outside the Dominican mission here in New York. Edwidge Dantacott.
Amy, there are actually two films now that are out on this subject that are extraordinary. One is The Price of Sugar, and one is a film called Sugar Babies that I narrate that deals with these issues. I think it's powerful what these protesters were saying, the focus that to focus some of the heat also on the sugar industry in the United States, and the fact that actually, in one of the documentaries, one of the sugar barons, who actually functions here in Florida and has had conflict with migrant labor in Florida and that are still unresolved, with lack of pay, the same issues that you have with some of these bates in the Dominican Republic. And he says something like, one out of, half of the sugar he's in every cereal box or something to that effect, that we consume his sugar in the United States. And people may not realize that there are some subsidies that are provided to these sugar-producing families in the Dominican Republic to produce the sugar that we use here in the United States. So these issues, they're connected, the issues of migration and the fact that these children are in transit for their entire lives. People who've been in the Dominican Republic for 50, 60 years are considered in transit. These issues and the conditions and the bates are very important, but I said it's important for people who live here to realize, it's not disconnected from you, because it's this is supported by the sugar we consume here in the United States.
Edwidge Dantacott, I want to thank you very much for being with us and congratulate you on your latest book, the deeply moving memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shrifa Dogadu, Aaron Mappe, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Carrie Mache, and Kizzy Cox. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Rebecca Silver, Annie Massoud, Samantha Chamblee, Jose Miranda. I'll be in Washington, D.C. at the Convention Center tomorrow, Saturday, 3 o'clock at the Green Festival. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.